Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Adam Ragusa. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. Robert Pinsky is one of America's best-known poets. He served as Poet Laureate of the United States from 1997 to 2000, and as part of that, launched the Favorite Poem Project. Pinsky is the author of 19 books of poetry and criticism, including The Figured Wheel, a collection of poems that won the 1997 Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize. It was also nominated that year for the Pulitzer Prize.
Now Robert Pinsky has a new collection of poetry called Selected Poems, which spans more than 35 years of his work. Robert Pinsky now teaches at Boston University. He's also the poetry editor for Slate Magazine, and he's in our studio right now to talk about his poetry, the state of poetry in the U.S., and to take your calls. And Robert Pinsky, welcome. What a pleasure to have you here.
My pleasure, Anthony.
Good to have you. I'm going to just put a question out to listeners. What questions do you have for Robert Pinsky? Do you make room in your life for poetry? Do you think poetry still has a place in this modern world dominated by the internet, instant messaging, and fast-paced mass culture? What poets do you still read? Are your kids still learning poetry in school? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And Robert Pinsky, this new collection, it spans many years. A lot of these poems go back to 1975. What was it like to sort of gather this and look back at all these years of writing poetry?
Compared to putting a lot of books together, it was emotional for me, just summing up your life. You know, if you are in broadcasting or medicine or law, or, you know, if you are a gardener, you don't necessarily at a certain age say, here are my selected works that I've done as a broadcaster. Maybe people do. It's an interesting exercise. And in the things you leave out, you want to be very sure that you're not saying this is terrible. You want to feel in your mind, well, I'm going to paint a little picture of what I've done.
And well, I was wondering about that because, of course, you would have to leave out so much. We mentioned 19 or 20 books of poems and, well, I guess poems and criticism, but still lots of poems.
A lot had to be left out.
Yeah.
And I was forced to do chronological reverse order. This is getting a little technical, a little inside baseball, but at first I thought, well, start at the beginning. Start when you were a young dude and wind up in the pre-senile present. And I couldn't do that because my first book had two long poems in it, and my second book was mostly one long poem. And for people who were new to my work, I didn't want to start with excerpts on the one hand or real long things on the other hand. So I started with the most recent work and went toward the back. I think it's interesting to sum up your life. I try to avoid this somewhat grim metaphor, but it's a little bit like designing your gravestone.
Oh, boy.
You're saying, what did Robert do? And I hope there'll be lots more. I hope there'll be lots more books.
Well, there's some beautiful poems in here, and I thought it would be good before we get to some callers. And by the way, if you're just joining us, our guest is Robert Pinsky, poet. He's got a new book called Robert Pinsky Selected Poems, and you can join the conversation about poetry and specifically about Robert Pinsky, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And I'm wondering, I was going through this book, and I would love you to read whatever you want to read, but could I ask you to read Street Music on page 75? I just love that.
I'll be happy to do that.
Thank you.
Poem that takes seriously the idea of reincarnation or previous lives. Street music, sweet Babylon, headphones, song bones. At a slate stairway's base, alone and unready, not far from the taxis and bars around the old stone station, in the bronze, ordinary afternoon light, to find yourself back behind that real city and inside this other city where you slept in the street. Your bare feet, gray tunic of a child, coarse sugar of memory. Salt Nineveh of barrows and stalls, the barber with his copper bowl, beggars and grain sellers. The alley of writers of letters in different dialects, stands of the ear cleaner, tailor, spicer, reign of Ashurbanipal, hemp woman, whore merchant, hand porter, errand boy, child sold from a doorway. Candy Memphis of exile and hungers, honey calends and drays, syrup sellers and sicknesses, runes, donkeys, yams, tunes on the mouth harp, shuffles and rags, healer, dealer, drunkard, fresh water, sewage. Wherever you died in the market, sometimes your soul flows a-hunting buried cakes here in the city.
Hmm. Great. Word jazz comes to mind. I mean, I just the jazz of a marketplace just seems to come through that poem so well.
I grew up in a small town where my dad and his friends all had shops on the main street. And I like streets. I like the sounds of streets. And when you say jazz, you please me so much because that was that's what I want the poem to do.
Well, that's what, and you said it's about metamorphosis. No, or about reincarnation.
It takes the idea of metempsychosis or reincarnation seriously. And of course, we all have, through our ancestors, we have had lives where we were princes and where we were beggars and sold, and so it's figurative too.
Well, it's such a pleasure to have you here. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK makes the connection with Robert Pinsky. And why don't we go right to some callers? Let's go to Gina, who's calling from Lexington. Hi, Gina.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
Thank you. Mr. Pinsky, I am a high school English teacher, and for the past couple of years, I've been moving away from the novel and incorporating much more poetry, essay, and short stories. And I'm wondering whether you think maybe the immediacy of poetry is more suited to this 21st century brain that's used to tweets and texts, or is that kind of just giving in to that, and should I be pushing them through those novels?
Great question.
You know, there's about 10 or 15 years at West Point, poetry was at the center of the humanities curriculum because the students there, they're mostly engineering students who also have a lot of military duty. They can't read a long Victorian novel very well. And reading poetry is suitable for those students. I'm a little bit of a skeptic about whether minds change from decade to decade, whether Twitter and Facebook changes the way people think. Poetry is very physical. You know, the novel with those rectangles of print, I love it. I'm not putting it down, but it's a post-industrial revolution form, those rectangles. And poetry goes back as far as there were people, these rhythmical grunts. And I think it's a rare toddler who doesn't like sitting on somebody's lap and hearing Edward Lear or Dr. Seuss or Robert Louis Stevenson. It's in us very deep. And I certainly, Gina, have a recommendation for you. I don't know if you know the videos at favoritepoem.org. I really urge you to go to favoritepoem.org. It's a great teaching tool. Your students can see a construction worker reading aloud Walt Whitman's poems and things like that.
In fact, we want to play some of those. Robert Pinsky, you're talking about this great project that you directed when you were U.S. Poet Laureate.
And Gina, high school teacher, you're exactly the person I think of in relation to that project. So
thank you. Yeah, that will be tremendously useful. Thanks so much.
I hope you send me an email or a letter after you've seen some of those videos and use them in your school.
I absolutely will.
Thank you, Gina.
I wanted to ask you about that. Talk a little bit more about that favorite poems project that you put together when you were Poet Laureate. What was the idea behind it?
The idea was to show something about the nature of poetry, namely that it's a bodily art, it's vocal, and to show something about the nature of the United States, namely that we're not such jerks and yahoos, that many, many Americans love poetry. People have spoken it as an example, as advocacy, or that I was marketing poetry. I never liked that. I was just gesturing towards what is there. Mm. I didn't tell people to read poetry. I asked Americans to write me a letter about a poem they loved.
And you got hundreds of submissions,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, thousands, tens
thousands.
Of thousands.
Yeah.
And it was not a poll. People had to write letters. It had to do with passion, not with counting. And fortunately, thanks to the Clinton White House and Millennial Celebration, we got to do it. And we made videos as well. And every July, we have K through 12 teachers who come to BU and hear lectures and also get those videos. But anybody can see them at favoritepoem.org.
Well, let's listen to a poem because we went on the website and took a few down from the website. And not took them down, but I mean recorded them so that we could play them right now. There's one by John Ulrich of South Boston who he was a student at Mass Art when he read We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks.
Mm-hmm.
And he says on the tape before he reads the poem, he remembers that he first encountered this poem in high school when a rash of teenage suicides hit his community. It resonated with him at a pretty high level. It's a short poem. Let's listen to it.
We real cool. We left school. We lurk late. We strike straight. We sing sin. We thin gin. We jazz June. We die soon.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
The medium for the artist Gwendolyn Brooks was John Ulrich's voice.
Really?
She never met him. She didn't know he existed. When she reads the poem, she reads it very differently from that. But when I think of my art, I don't want... The peak of it is not when I'm giving a poetry reading. You say, oh, beautiful poetry reading. The peak of it is if some equivalent of John Ulrich someday says something by me aloud. To me, that's the most glorious thing I can imagine, is to write some words and have someone else want to say them aloud.
You must have been, though, incredibly heartened by the response you got to that project. Thousands of people writing in. Because you say your job wasn't to market poetry, but you have argued forcefully for the relevance of poetry in the modern age.
The word I use is fundamental or basic. And to me, poetry it's too large to be marketed or to be advocated for. It's not a brand of soap. And, it felt great to realize there were all those people all around the country who were taking the trouble to write those letters and who let us make those videos. Really, it was one guy at the NEA, Cliff Becker, who I'm sad to say there was a young guy who passed away. Cliff Becker saw to it that we got to make those videos, and the Clinton White House, our charge was a portrait of the United States of America in the year 2000 through the lens of poetry. You know, and not the lens of sports or the news or something. I think we did it. The video show America as well as showing something about poetry.
Listeners, we're talking to poet Robert Pinsky about his latest collection called Selected Poems and also about the state of poetry, I guess, in the U.S. right now. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Ed, who's calling from Gardner. Hi, Ed.
Hello, Ed.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I'm Pinsky. I went to listen to you read your poems in Albany about, I don't know, I think it was about 10 years ago. And you read from a list of poems. One of them was the Triangle Shirt Factory.
Yes.
Poem. Did you write that?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought so. And I was wondering if you can, you know, it's the centennial of the that tragedy. And I was wondering if you could, you know, speak to that. And
Ed, let me intervene here because that's one of the poems I was going to ask Mr. Pinsky to read. It's in this collection. Could we ask you to read that right now?
Sure, I'll be happy to. And Ed, I'm not kidding. I did write it, but it does quote lots of different things, including some stuff from a book by a guy named Hobsbawm, whose book he talks about the invention of tradition. And his point is that a lot of things that are supposedly old, like the kilt or the regalia of the Queen of England, it's a sort of like the poem, like the triangle shirtwaist fire. It's something that questions a lot of old social arrangements. Shirt, the back, the yoke, the yardage, lapped seams, the nearly invisible stitches along the collar turned in a sweatshop by Koreans or Malaysians gossiping over tea and noodles on their break or talking money or politics, while one fitted this arm piece with its overseam to the band of cuff eye button at my wrist. The presser, the cutter, the ringer, the mangle, the needle, the union, the treadle, the bobbin, the code, the infamous blaze at the Triangle Factory in 1911. 146 died in the flames on the ninth floor. No hydrants, no fire escapes. the witness in a building across the street who watched how a young man helped a girl to step up to the windowsill, then held her out away from the masonry wall and let her drop, and then another, as if he were helping them up to enter a streetcar, and not eternity. A third, before he dropped her, put her arms around his neck and kissed him. Then he held her into space and dropped her. Almost at once, he stepped to the sill himself. His jacket flared and fluttered up from his shirt as he came down, air filling up the legs of his gray trousers. Like Hart Crane's bedlamite, shrill shirt ballooning. Wonderful how the pattern matches perfectly across the placket and over the twin bar-tacked corners of both pockets, like a strict rhyme or a major chord. Prints, plaids, checks, houndstooth, Tattersall, Madras, the clan tartans invented by mill owners inspired by the hoax of Ossian to control their savage Scottish workers, tamed by a fabricated heraldry, MacGregor, Bailey, MacMartin. The kilt, devised for workers to wear among the dusty clattering looms, weavers, carders, spinners. The loader, the docker, the navvy, the planter, the picker, the sorter sweating at her machine in a litter of cotton as slaves in calico head rags sweated in fields. George Herbert, your descendant is a black lady in South Carolina. Her name is Irma, and she inspected my shirt. Its color and fit and feel and its clean smell have satisfied both her and me. We have culled its cost and quality down to the buttons of simulated bone, the button holes, the sizing, the facing, the characters printed in black on neckband and tail, the shape, the label, the labor, the color, the shade, the shirt.
So, it's so great. Can you tell me about the cadence that you were come back to in that poem and the way it ended? I mean, is it evokes
the poem is written in 4/4 time in a way.
Yeah.
That is, it's in its own buried and weird way. It is an iambic pentameter, which is the great measure of English. It's what Shakespeare wrote all his plays in, Paradise Lost and all that. And I have this other sort of my own New Jersey way of thinking about the needle, the union, the bobble, the bobbin, the treadle, those substantives, one of which are just bobbled. That's what the whole art is for me. It's just the art of the ear and the voice. You try to get your brain in there too, but the main organs are the voice box and the ear.
There's a lot of brain, though, in there. I mean, I read somewhere earlier today when I was doing research for this segment that I came across a quote that you said that when you were a youth, I enjoyed reading things I couldn't understand. I liked the smoky atmosphere and haze of reading something too old or simply opaque.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that still sort of describes the power and the sort of mystery of poetry to you.
Yeah, I think the whole... I think that it's true in movies and music. People who love rock music or hip-hop or opera are disappointed if they understand everything about the tune the first time they hear it.
Yeah.
Part of the pleasure is gradually seeing things emerge. Hmm. And certainly it's true that when I was a kid, I loved reading books that were too old for me. I didn't know what they were about, but I could feel the rhythms of them. Maybe it comes from having a kind of Orthodox Jewish upbringing, and I did a lot of praying in a language I could read phonetically and only knew a word here and there. I'm stuck in that.
But it gets to this tension that I think that a lot of people struggle with poetry. I mean, this tension about when do you want a poem and to what extent do you want a poem to be understood so that it's immediately accessible, and to what extent do you want to layer it in opaque meaning? I mean, I know it's not a binary discussion, but...
The main thing is to have a good time, it's to have fun. Art is for pleasure. I think very well-earned meaning, earnest teaching has given people the idea that a poem is mainly a test to see if you can say something smart. And it's not. It's a work of art.
Let's see if we can get at least one more call in. Let's go to Rebecca, who's calling from Foxborough. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
I just wanted to share. I wanted to share how we've made poetry part of our daily life in my family. And we're not a religious family, but in place of grace before our dinner, we've been reading a poem instead. I have two small children, and it's been a really nice tradition that we've started.
Oh, Rebecca, to use the wrong expression, bless you.
Thanks.
It sounds great to me.
Thank you, Rebecca, so much. I wanted to ask you, getting back to this idea of jazz, I read that your introduction to the arts, you played the saxophone.
Saxophone and some keyboard, yeah.
So you were on your way to being a jazz man. How did you make that parting in the road and end up going toward poetry?
Here comes one of my repeated jokes. I would be a famous jazz player today, except for the single obstacle of a deficiency of musical talent. It's the only thing that held me back.
Minor detail. I don't know why you let that hold you back.
I was still playing even after I went to college, and I was playing sort of inglorious gigs and bars and weddings and things. And there was one now legendary night when I went back to audition with the guys he used to play with. I stunk up the place, and on the way home I decided to be a great poet instead of a great musician.
Well, tell us about what you're doing this weekend, because it is this nice marriage of your art and the jazz that you love.
Well, at Sunday night at 7 at Oberon, which is the ART's club in Arrow Street in Harvard Square, I'll be reading my poems accompanied by some wonderful musicians, jazz players, though they are also, besides being jazz players, they're also the band of the wonderful singer-songwriter Josh Ritter.
Mm.
I got to know Josh a few years ago. And I'll be doing that Sunday night. I'm also reading my poems Thursday night at DU, the Photonic Center.
Well, Robert Pinsky, I wish we had more time. We had more listeners to get to. Thank you so much for coming in. It was such a pleasure.
I enjoyed it. And God, Ed and Gina and Rebecca, that was...
don't we have good
first-class callers?
We've got great listeners and great callers.
They were great.
That's Robert Pinsky, poet Robert Pinsky. He's the former U.S. Poet Laureate and a Boston University professor. His latest collection of poems is called Robert Pinsky Selected Poems. And we'll be right back after a short break. Up next, it takes two to tango and apparently two press conferences to get the Massachusetts census data right. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Adam Ragusa. This is Radio Boston.